Welcome to Kylie Says It's About to Get Real. I chose the name of this podcast after most of my friends would say, shit Kylie says, after I'd share a deep thought or perspective on something that always ended in more conversations. I started this podcast out of a period of spiritual curiosity that caused me to do deep dives into manifestation, meditation, and mindset and perception work that had me exploring things like angel numbers, life path numbers, human design, mediumship, Akashic records researching, and more, all while overcoming a traumatic eating disorder and trying to thrive as a postpartum mom of two while building my corporate career. This show is a mix of guest interviews and my take on life, love, friendship, and all of the topics that I find interesting. Here, we talk to experts, authors, entrepreneurs, and more. If you're looking for a show to get you out of your rut, you found it. Welcome to Kylie Says. I'm your host, Kylie, and I promise to entertain you, give it to you straight, be real with you, and have some fun along the way. Welcome back to Kylie Says. I hope that your new year was amazing. And I hope that you have been using the past few days to do some reflections. Maybe you tried that audit that I had covered in my last podcast episode. If not, I'll link that episode below in the show notes so that you can re-listen to that one or listen to it for the first time and see what you think about that audit, because I think that it might just be one of the most memorable things you do that becomes an absolute pattern for you moving forward as we hop from year to year. Because as they say, when you're a parent, the nights are long, but the years are slow or something like that. And I think that that's 100% true. And that's actually a decent topic for what we're going to cover today. I will say, PSA, if you do not yet subscribe and you have not yet rated the show, it would mean so much to me. One of my personal goals is to increase, or I don't want to say increase because I don't totally care about that, but it would be awesome to hear from you in regards to what you're thinking of the show so far. So if you are open to leaving a review, if there's an episode that you love, or you're open to subscribing, that would mean a lot. And thank you. Today, I want to cover something that's been on my mind a little bit lately. And sometimes when I'm on social media, I feel like I see a lot of things that make me feel a little bit sad about parenting and just people that treat their children really poorly and are on social media doing things like that. And it just makes me so absolutely bewildered that someone would want to become a parent and then take out their own trauma on a child. It literally just does not make any sense to me. And it is deeply disturbing and upsetting as someone who has personally worked through a lot of their own trauma to avoid passing any of that down to my children. So I don't know why I see some of those things, but it got me thinking about something that I feel like is really important to talk about. And that's this idea of your children feeling vulnerable enough in front of you to be able to act out. And I was listening to a podcast, or I saw something on social media. I frankly can't remember exactly what it was, but there was something that I read that said, if your children feel safe enough in front of you to act out, to talk back to you, and this is when they're little, say like up until maybe 6 or 7, they feel safe enough to cry, they feel safe enough to talk about their feelings or express these big emotions, that is a gift, because that means that you have created an environment where your child feels safe going through those motions, and they are not fearful of being hit, they are not fearful of being scolded, they are comfortable enough with you to be able to let out and express a feeling that they're going through, and then have you help them navigate what that feeling means, and have you help them navigate how to work through something. At this age, when our children are, you know, around 5 or so, I feel like is when you start really seeing their personality and when you start seeing things come out, like anxiety, like fear of being made fun of, some of those sorts of things that you didn't really see when your kids were younger because they're young and they don't care and that doesn't cross their mind. And I've been thinking a lot about some of the things that I felt as a child and how those things were never necessarily addressed, because obviously you never talk about them. But I feel like I'm an incredibly perceptive person, and also I feel like I'm highly empathetic. And as a result, I feel things quite deeply, but I also am very in tune with the feelings of those that are super close to me, especially when it comes to my kids. I feel like I can look at them and kind of know what they're feeling, which is when they run over to me and give me a hug or if I can tell they're feeling some way and I go over and try to kind of like affirm their feeling for them, but ask them to tell me what they're feeling. Then if they're shaking their head no, then giving them a few options. Let me say two things and you tell me which one, number one or number two, like which one feels kind of similar to how you're feeling right now. Because I also don't want to put any words in my kids' mouths. I want them to be able to tell me how they're feeling. I don't want to say, this is how you're feeling, right? I want to say, is this how you're feeling? And if they say no, then I'm like, okay, then do you want to tell me how you're feeling? Do you feel sad? Do you feel confused? Do you feel a little scared? Is this a little uncomfortable for you? Which one might it be? And then allow them to make an option and choose. And I think it's super important. Some kids, especially when they're little like this, they don't know what they're feeling. They don't know what those words mean. So teaching about feelings and emotions and how to work through those. You know, when I feel this way, some things that I usually do are I take a deep breath, or I come over and I hold hands with daddy, or I do XYZ. And so you're giving them not only the room to feel vulnerable and to tell you or have you help them explore what they might be feeling, but you're also giving them some sort of a coping mechanism. And I feel like so many of us grew up with parents who didn't know how to cope with certain situations because they never talked about them. So it's by no fault of their own. But their parents also didn't talk about those things. So they grew up not really knowing how to address them. And now, luckily, we're in this period where I feel like it's become a lot more cool to establish and know yourself well enough to understand that when you are going through some sort of an experience, there is a coping mechanism that you can follow, or you find one, you explore, and you figure out what might work for you. But I think it's incredibly important that we teach our kids how to develop coping mechanisms. I think it is highly unlikely that this next generation will grow up without figuring out more coping mechanisms. And that ideally will lead to less drug and alcohol addiction, because in my mindset, a lot of those things that become tools are really this pull to feel less and experience less, hurt less. But in order to do that, you need something more. So what are you looking for? Instead of trying to find some sort of a healing process, you're completely avoiding the healing process. Therefore, you're turning to something that gives you this impact and this high that lasts for a few minutes, but you're always chasing more and more. And yes, I do absolutely believe that addiction is a disease, but I do think that there are ways that we can teach our children coping mechanisms from a younger age that will help them want to avoid some of that behavior later on, because they'll have the tools in their tool belt to enable them to make a better decision than to feel like they have to hide in their grief or in their pain or in their embarrassment. They won't feel like they have to hide away from their feelings. They'll feel like they can tackle them head on. Experimentation, of course, I think that comes with young adulthood, etc. I was one of those kids, but I do think that it's important to know that there are ways to cope outside of turning to something like that. In fact, I wanted to look at a little bit of data to kind of back up some of what I'm saying. So let's get into that. According to parents.com, and this article was from July 2024, a study published in the Journal of Addictive Behaviors found that adolescents who use avoidance coping, which is when kids steer clear of something in order to deal with the stress that it causes, so basically saying, I avoid that this is even happening, I'm going to completely ignore it, those adolescents who use that coping strategy are more likely to use marijuana. And those who lack problem-solving skills have higher lifetime marijuana use. And this is just one example of how a lack of coping skills could lead potentially to an unhealthy dependence on something else. However, on the flip side, this article says, kids who learn healthy coping skills at an early age may enjoy some big advantages in life. And that a study published in the American Journal of Public Health discovered a significant association between social-emotional skills in kindergarten and well-being in adulthood. And researchers found that children who are able to regulate their emotions at age 5 were more likely to go to college and have steady jobs as adults, and these kids were also less likely to use substances, engage in criminal activity, or have mental health issues. So the tip from this article is that coping skills are super important because they provide kids with methods to regulate their emotions. And during challenging times, teens who know how to regulate will avoid unhealthy coping skills like drug use and avoidance. And I just think that one of the things in this episode that I think is really important, that is similar again to what I was talking about, is helping kids understand how to label their feelings. So being able to label your feelings is basically just being able to verbalize like, I'm mad or I am nervous. And it can give kids the words that they need to help describe their feelings, because like I was saying, they often lack the vocabulary to be able to say how they feel. And that's why certain books, like those that maybe are feeling faces or posters, like the ones that they have at the ER, how are you feeling? And it has a smiley face, a super smiley face, a calm face, or like a no smile, a sad face, and then like a writhing in pain face. And then the kids are asked to describe which one you're feeling, because they know things based on visuals. They don't know things. Maybe this means I'm really happy, I don't feel bad at all. So we need to help them identify the words and the way to do that, so that they don't then feel like, I have no idea what this is that I'm feeling, I'm so overwhelmed, etc. And so I think that that's just something that is super important today. And another thing that I think we talk about a lot, or that I've talked about a lot on this podcast, is this idea of negative self-talk. And that when your kids are displaying behavior where they want to completely avoid a situation, or they don't want to play a song that they usually dance to with just their family because they think they might get embarrassed in front of other people, then they start going negative. No one wants to see me dance. I'm not good at dancing. And I've already noticed that when with my five-year-old. So teaching your kids how to speak a little bit nicer to themselves. Why do you not want to dance today? Oh, you're embarrassed? Why would you be embarrassed to dance in front of your family? Don't you know that you are a good dancer? What would you say if your brother didn't want to do this? Would you tell him to dance and have fun? Do you care about having fun? You do. Does dancing feel fun to you? Yes. Okay, well, maybe we can try it, and we don't need to be afraid because we're in front of people that love and care about us. And yes, I know that sounds like kind of silly, but at the end of the day, it is important to help your kids work through those things and figure out what might be going on and how you can help them. And then how you can then give them good feedback when you see that they're using some of the tools and those tips, so that they are empowered then to choose what works best for them, but they have some options in how to do so because you've been working with them. And so I think that it's important to remember that the regulation of emotions that you have, that you're still likely working through, will likely have an incredibly difficult time not transferring some of that emotion to your children. And so I think that something to just be mindful of is this idea that if you know that you have certain trauma and situations, you have terrible anxiety, the more that you say out loud, I have anxiety, it's great as an adult to be able to recognize it. It's bad as an adult to say it so much that your kids start thinking that they have this thing called anxiety because they are now afraid to do some of the things that you have been so vocal about. So I would be mindful about working on some of your own traumas and identifying some of your own feelings in front of your kids without then giving them a coping mechanism that they can watch you replicate, so that they know how to work through those emotions themselves. If you say something like, I'm so anxious to fly on an airplane, your kids are likely going to adopt that and be really scared to fly on an airplane. If one of the kids says, I'm afraid of the flusher in the toilet, like my children are, the other one is then going to say that they're afraid of the toilet when they weren't before, because they didn't know that that was something that they could be afraid of. They didn't know that that was something that they could feel. So there's a flip side to this, and making sure that you're not creating more trauma situations than you are solving them. I think it's absolutely okay to talk with your kids about how you're feeling if you are feeling something like that, but I think it's really important to then give them a tip, a trick, a tool that you are adopting yourself to show them that it's okay to work through something. It's okay to feel something, because I've developed this tool and here's how it helps me, and make it a game. One tip that I have for helping kids with any vulnerabilities is truly gamifying everything. I think that there is nothing smarter than to gamify your experiences for kids, especially as they're trying to teach them a lesson, because what kid does not want to play a game with their parents? DiscoveryEducation.com has this article talking about gamification in the classroom, learning through play. And it asks, what is gamification in learning? And specifically for this piece of advice, They're looking about, they're asking the question about what is gamification, and it's the practice of strategically adding some game elements into a learning experience to boost motivation, create a heightened sense of achievement, encourage a growth mindset, and age with knowledge retention. And that through gamified experiences, students can become more receptive to learning. And I think that goes in or outside of the classroom. And it says, in practice, some of these things might look like introducing a point scoring system to encourage self-improvement. We have a thing called Dojo Points through this app called Class Dojo. And we now give each other fake Dojo Points at our house for something good. Oh, you earned a snack because you got a dojo point, or I got a dojo point that one of my kids gave me because I played with them for a little bit. And so it's a way of us saying, you got 2 dojo points, you got 1 dojo point, you got 5 dojo points. And that means that there's something that you did well, something that we liked that you did, something that gave you this chance to earn a point. And so that in our house goes a long way. Using dice to generate a random number or decide the order of activities. I also think you could do something like, we're going to write these all down and put them in a hat, and whichever one we pick out first, that's the game that we're going to play. You want to create this sense of fair, this sense of, okay, it's okay to lose that thing you didn't, that you really wanted to do. We'll now do second based on whatever the circumstances are. Promoting healthy competition using teams or a leaderboard. In our house, we have a very difficult time with losing, both from adults and from children. And so figuring out ways where we can share who wins is an important part of the learning process here. Something as simple as running up the stairs. If we know that one person usually wins, then saying like, can we let so-and-so win this time? Because they're still growing and aren't as fast as us yet. So let's share, and next time, maybe you can win. And yes, I know it's not right to always say, let your kid win, let so-and-so win. But I think it's important to say that you can't always win and you have to be okay with losing, and teaching that as a learning experience. Especially when we're talking about like a quite young toddler who we're saying, let's let them win so that they can feel how fun it is to have people cheering for them, etc. Setting a time limit to boost focus. This is something that I've actually found works really well for us at night when we're saying that we want X more minutes until we go upstairs. We'll usually set an alarm on our Alexa. And then when that alarm goes off, I use that as an opportunity to say, hey, everybody, this is when we're going to clean up. As soon as we hear that alarm, we're going to clean up. Or if we're going to one of my husband's basketball games, it's as soon as we hear the big buzzer, we're going to go over to the snack bar, okay? Or as soon as we hear the big buzzer, we're going to all go to the bathroom together. So that I'm giving them this set time limit to expect something, but then I'm following through on whatever that expectation is. So if I say, once we hear this buzzer, once we hear this alarm, we're going to do the cleanup song. If I don't do the cleanup song, then they lose the ability to think that I'm being serious or that I'm actually being honest with what I say is going to happen next. Creating a compelling storyline to tie learning points together. I am very much a storyteller in literally my job, in this format, and in life. So I try to create stories out of everything. Like, once there was a little girl who didn't clean up her toys. Then she had so many toys she didn't know what to do with them. Once she didn't know what toys she had, she kept wanting more and more until she had so much that she liked nothing at all because there was nothing put away and she couldn't find any of the good toys. One way that helped with this is being able to put things away and help organize. Organizing is this, yada, yada. And sometimes they don't care about my stories and they just are like, okay, whatever, great. But other times they're like, oh, well, do I have a lot of toys? Yes, I think you do. Do we know where all my toys are? No, they're all over the place. There's too many. Okay, well, should we clean? Maybe we should. And then incentivizing or inventing incentives such as badges, medals, new challenges to unlock, and giving instant feedback so that kids can track their own progress. And you can gamify anything without technology, but I do think that you need to have a little bit of planning when you're thinking about gamifying something for your kids, but also just this idea of allowing them to be vulnerable and then giving them some sort of a life lesson from that. In fact, let's look at a little bit of data about vulnerability in toddlers. Let's start with a quote. In her book, Children Learn What They Live, Dorothy Law Nolte wrote with great insight about the impact of a child's upbringing. If children live with criticism, they learn to condemn. If children live with fear, they learn to be apprehensive. If children live with ridicule, they learn to feel shy. If children live with encouragement, they learn confidence. If children learn with acceptance, they learn to love. That is so true. And something that I think is incredibly important when we're talking about this idea of bringing vulnerability into the home and helping our children feel that they can use us as a mirror when it comes to identifying their emotions, their feelings, and how to cope. And this idea of teaching coping mechanisms at a young age, and also having your children that are older help teach their children that are younger things that they have learned. What's something that you learned at school today about what to do when you feel like this? And then give them the opportunity to be the teacher. I think that's also so important. Giving your kids the opportunity to teach your other kids or to teach you something and to show you what they've learned, and then to be proud that they learned something and they felt comfortable enough to share it at home. And then they'll remember it. Kids are absolute sponges. I am shocked at all of the things that my 5-year-old remembers, things that I've said, things that I did, phrases that I've said. She will remember everything and then use it and tell us later on, remember when you did this? So it's important to know that even when you think they're not paying attention, they are. So it's incredibly important to think through how this emotional bonding can establish this security and the foundation upon all facets of their identity and how they're built in literally the life of every child. And in order for kids to really know themselves, we need to know ourselves, and we need to be able to share how we got to that place so that we don't grow up with kids who are afraid to get to know themselves, or who end up going to college like me and getting there and feeling like, who the heck am I? I used to want to be other people so bad that I would copy their handwriting. I would copy the way they did their hair. I would copy the way that they dressed. I would ask for things that I knew other kids had because I wanted them. I would go to other people's houses and I would be very much in tune with how they treated their parents, how their parents treated them, how they treated their siblings, the things that they wore, the things they said they like, because I felt like I was in this period of just having no idea of who I was and who I was meant to be. And I was consistently trying on other personalities, other writing styles, other this, other that. I even tried to write with my left hand at one point. I'm right-handed. I do not need to write with my left hand for any dang reason. So helping your kids know who they are and then validating, yes, this is you and this is amazing, this is why you're so special, is so important. Here's some interesting data from the CDC according to children's mental health. 96% of children usually or always are affectionate and tender with their parents or caregivers that do not have some sort of mental health issue. And 83% of kids, normal kids that have emotional affection at home, usually or always bounce back when things do not go their way. And 95% of these kids usually or always show interest and curiosity in learning new things. And 99% of those kids usually or always smile and laugh. That is amazing. And these are indicators of positive mental health that are present in most children. And this is national US data from 2021 to 2022. And those stats that I read were based on how nearly 4 out of 5 children from ages 6 months to 5 years exhibited all four indicators of flourishing. And 3 out of 5 children ages 6 to 17 exhibited all three indicators of flourishing, which was curiosity and showing new things, always staying calm or in control when faced with a challenge, and working to finish a task when they start. And according to data from 2018 and 2019, childhood mental health conditions affect many children and families. And in 1 in 7 children aged 3 to 17, or 13%, had a current diagnosed mental or behavioral health condition. And mental health conditions can begin in early childhood, and the prevalence will change with age, sorry, not eggs. And although there are some exceptions, most mental health conditions are more common with increased age. So the chart that I'm looking at from this research shows that, let's see, 2.2% of children ages 3 to 5 showed signs of anxiety, with the highest amount of kids, with the strongest amount being 15% for kids aged 12 to 17. Luckily, no 3 to 5-year-olds expressed any depression. And then 4.6% of children ages 3 to 5 had some sort of a behavior disorder. And those were the anxiety problems, behavior disorders, and depression are the most commonly diagnosed mental disorders in children based on that data from 2021 to 22. And guess who had more anxiety, males or females? Ages 3 to 17. If you guess females, you'd be correct. For diagnosed behavior disorders, it is a 50% higher rate in males than females. So 7% of children aged 3 to 17 had some sort of a current diagnosed behavior disorder. And then some of these mental health conditions commonly occur together. So in 2018 to 2019, among those children with mental health condition, more than 1 in 3 had two or more conditions. And that's so crazy. So among these children ages 3 to 17 with a current health condition, just barely over half of them received treatment, and 43% took a medication for emotional concentration or behavioral condition. And it says here in bold, it's important to remember that diagnosed conditions do not tell the whole story about mental distress in children. I think that is the most important fact. You may not have all of the answers, and you may not be able to diagnose your own child, and that is totally fine. But it's important that if you don't address some of these things, by the time that your kids get to be an adolescent, mental health, substance use, and suicide do become concerns. And the scope of these problems can really increase. Data from 2023 says that among US high school students, 40% reported persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness in the past year. 20% attempted considering suicide in the past year. 16% reported they had made a suicide plan in the last year. 22% reported drinking alcohol in the past 30 days. Mind you, these are kids that are in high school. 17% reported using marijuana in the past 30 days. And 4% reported that they were misusing their prescription pain medication or someone else's in the past 30 days. And so, again, when it comes to helping with our children and providing an emotional and vulnerable place for them to be themselves, and then helping them learn and grow and providing coping mechanisms and helping them regulate their emotions, we literally all have a role to play in this. So again, data from 2021 to 2022 from adolescents who were 12 to 17 indicated that 59%, which is amazing, reported that they always or usually received social and emotional support. 64% reported that they received parental support a lot of the time, and 81% of them reported that they have at least one adult in their life who makes a positive difference. I'm going to pause there on all the stats because I threw so much data at you, but I think that that is so important, and especially important to know that one adult in their life who makes a positive difference, that could be a coach, that could be a teacher, that could be a grandparent, that could be a friend of a friend, that could be an auntie who's only really an auntie because you're super close with, you know, because you're super close with them, and that person becomes very close with your child. So think about that. I know as a parent, I want my kids to grow up and cite that they feel that I am one of the adults in their life who made a positive difference for them. And I would love to be able to do that for other kids too. But of course, being able to do that for my own children is incredibly, incredibly important. And sorry that some of those data points were a little bit dark. I was reading them for the first time as I was reading them aloud on the podcast. So I think they're still important to know, but I'll put a disclaimer in the episode just because I think that it's important to call those things out in advance so that you know what you're going to get. However, creating a vulnerable place, this is just as much a message for parents, and for those of you that are not parents, really a message for anyone. You don't have to be a parent to learn how to know yourself and to start getting vulnerable to accept and experience what's happening in your life and to create some appropriate coping mechanisms to get through it. Because by the time you do have a kid, or by the time you're listening to this episode, or by the time you realize that this is important, you want to have some sort of a foundation upon which you can make decisions that won't be based out of this feeling of stress overwhelm, anxiety. When I was going through my eating disorder, a lot of those initial emotions were a result of me feeling completely out of control, and that was my one way of creating more control for myself, because I would get physically and emotionally and mentally completely out of control and go into this, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like I would go into this vacuum where all I could do is eat as many things as possible just to purge. The purge was my release. That was my action. That was my ownership. That was when I would finally be able to take a deep breath and my anxiety would subside. It was like I was so overwhelmed by anxiety, I could not physically stop myself. And this is why I cold turkeyed everything, because I knew at the time that if I tried to talk through everything, cold turkey everything, go through this process one by one, account my food and make sure this and that, it would be way too overwhelming for me. And I had to make a decision about what is the most important thing that I need to stop now. And it was that behavioral pattern. Then I could start digging into why am I experiencing this behavioral pattern? When is this behavioral pattern coming up? But I needed to cold turkey the behavior pattern to be able to take a step back and look at the pattern I was creating. Yes, someone else could have told me that, but I'm someone who needs to learn and I need to experience things and I need to create a coping mechanism for myself. That allowed me to heal that part of my emotional trigger and response so that it's no longer even an option for me. I don't even consider that. I don't even feel those feelings half the time anymore because I've taken steps to allow myself to cope through them where it no longer is the immediate place that I go when I'm feeling overwhelmed, when I'm feeling insecure, when I'm feeling whatever. And that was something that I would do in any social situation, at anyone's house, in any bathroom, like anywhere that I possibly felt that I needed to, I would. And that is so disgusting and terrifying to think that that was my response for dealing with high stress, for dealing with thinking that everything that I ate was so bad for me, or I had so much guilt that I was unworthy of eating that because of how I looked, that I needed to do things to better take care of it. That's pretty much where I was coming from. And so this is just a PSA to anyone who is also feeling any of those feelings that A, you can absolutely change for the better, but you have to take the time to be willing to do the work yourselves. And you don't have to start where everyone tells you to start, by no means, but you just have to start, and you have to start somewhere. And especially if you're a parent, it's going to be important for you to make sure that you're addressing those things so that your children know how to appropriately deal with situations and you're giving them room to regulate their emotions in a healthy way that will not trigger them to want to adopt patterns that you are still dealing with today as an adult. Because if you're still dealing with those patterns, imagine when you first learned about them. Imagine how you probably feel knowing that no one really helped you address them or no one really talks about them because it wasn't something that you did. Break that pattern so that you can actually be the person who is encouraging others in your family to be better, to do better, to identify ways to feel better, because if your family feels good, your experiences will be good. And you want your kids to be positive influences for other kids. And no, they don't have to think about how they're going to coach other kids through this, but they need to think about how they're going to respond to situations when you're not there. And giving them the tools to do that is going to be so, so incredibly important now or later. To finish this episode off, we are going to use my favorite Oracle cards, the Animal Apothecary Guidebook cards. These are by Cara Elizabeth, and this was given to me by Nicole Maroline. So thank you, Nicole. And we're going to shuffle some cards. My kids have played with a lot of these cards. I hope that I have all of them. But we're going to go through, and we're just going to shuffle some cards because I want to pull a card at the end of this episode to help encourage, leave you with some wisdom, ensure that we're not leaving on a negative note, because some of what we covered today probably felt a little bit dark, and I want to leave every single one of you feeling good when you leave this show. So I'm shuffling the cards right now until I feel like we have shuffled to my heart's desire, and until I feel like I'm being drawn to the card that we are meant to pull today, because I want us to leave with a message of hope, with a message of perseverance, with a message of love. And this is the card I'm being pulled toward. So let's see what this card is. Okay, we pulled the card that is immense growth. And this is under the messages and medicine of the card. So immense growth is a vulture. And this is going to be on page... Whoa. I just turned to the exact page in this guidebook. The guidebook that comes along with this is... How many pages is this? Let's see. 110 pages long. I turned to the exact page in this guidebook, which is the immense growth card. Okay, so let's see what this says. Immense growth, the vulture. The vulture comes to speak to us about the wisdom of the sacredness of suffering. In Buddhism, the first noble truth is that all life involves suffering. It's not something to be escaped, but to be accepted. Only when we accept this law of our existence are we able to transmute and grow from suffering. Vulture sustains her life by living off that which is dead. She does not interfere by bringing a quicker death to her prey. Instead, she allows it to endure what it must, and its suffering ends in its natural time. This mirrors back to us the importance of patience. There's a profound lesson in the name of the turkey vulture, Cathartis aura, meaning golden purifier. They indeed purify the landscapes by removing decomposing carcasses that could spread disease and harmful bacteria. In the same way vulture cleanses the land, suffering purifies the heart from and removes the veils of ego. Suffering comes in two forms. Both are meant for growth. The first form is inflicted upon us and out of our control. The second form is self-inflicted, created from the attachments and illusions of our ego. Whatever form your own suffering takes, you must first accept it. When we resist the pain, when we resist aspects of ourselves we do not like, when we resist rejection, we perpetuate self-inflicted suffering. It's only when we accept it that pain begins to do what it was meant to do, transform us. This is the genius alchemical property behind acceptance. It transmutes. Vulture's medicine asks you to understand that pain, suffering, and trauma hold an energetic power. It's your choice whether to allow that power to attack you or to transmute its energy into your greatest asset. If you choose the latter, within you a hidden gift will be revealed far greater than all your pain. I think that that was an incredibly wise lesson for this episode. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we have our first interview of 2025, and it is a goodie, so make sure that you come back next Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific for that episode. Thank you again, and please feel free to rate the show or subscribe if you're enjoying the content. And if you're interested in figuring out a little bit more about yourself this year and you're considering human design or a human design reading, you can go ahead and book or inquire about booking with me at my website, goldenhourwithkylie.com. Thank you so much. See you next week.